my love of yesteryear.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend Singing Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
With a nostalgic nod toward the Atwater Kent, we now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Tonight, the fifth and final chapter of Marvin Miller's radio memoirs.
Jergens Lotion and Woodbury Soap present the Luella Parsons Show.
What famous star named a pretty model his life insurance beneficiary?
What opposing political families may be united by the marriage of their children?
What top star is the center of a big legal battle?
You will be given the answers transcribed from Hollywood by your Jergens Woodbury reporter, Luella Parsons, motion picture editor of International News Service. Luella will also present Doris Day with the Paige Cavanaugh Trio. But first, here with the Hollywood headlines is Luella Parsons.
A big hello to all of you, and my thanks to Rosalind Russell, Dorothy L'Amour, and Harriet Parsons for so ably giving you the Hollywood news in my absence. And now, my first exclusive. My announcer, Marvin Miller, and his lovely wife, Elizabeth, expect a baby in March. Marvin said, I thought you'd never get home from your vacation, so I could tell you first. Well, Marvin, I'd have died if anyone else had gotten it first. And now, here's Marvin Miller himself.
My name was perhaps linked most obviously, not because people heard the show so frequently, and they did, but not because of that, but because this lady was impersonated by more comics because of her rather unique style of delivery. And every other item was usually prefaced by my name. And, of course, I'm referring to Luella Parsons, whose announcer I was during all the years she had her 15-minute Sunday gossip program on the air. She'd say, Marvin, I have an exclusive from so-and-so. And so, go into it, you know. Luella was one of my all-time favorite people. Luella, in many cases, was like a little girl when it came to pouting about something, but I never knew her to be vicious or unpleasant or in any way a difficult person to get along with, and we had a lot of fun together. She knew how bad she sounded. She never learned to speak. She just happened to be one of the world's greatest newspaper women when it came to having a nose for news. She would smell out a story when there wasn't a hint of it. Somehow or other, she got vibrations through the air, and she'd call people up. I've seen her do it just before the show. She had a hunch that somebody had something, and she'd call them up, and by God, she got the exclusive. And she had this feeling. They call it a nose for news, and I suppose she had it. But that's the reason, certainly not her voice, that she was the great Hollywood columnist that she was. And try though they might, neither the Hedda Hoppers or the Jimmy Fiddlers or anybody else could ever surpass her in popularity. And I was on her show all the years that that was on as a 15-minute show. I remember, well, one of the funny things, the half hour was sponsored by Woodbury. The first 15 minutes was Jergens Lotion, and that was Walter Winchell from New York with Lotions of Love. The second 15 minutes was Woodbury, and that was Luella from Hollywood. She had a deal with Walter whereby he would not take a Hollywood item unless it was such a big item that it couldn't be, it actually was more news than Hollywood. And in that case, he was to wire her and let her know that he was going to take the story. Being on the air first, of course, she had no recourse. He had the first jump. But she would always she'd be sure she had her program entirely timed, and then she'd have to sit there and listen to Walter. And week after week, Walter would break the agreement and sneak one in from Hollywood. And the profanity ran around the room a little bit at that point, but she sure couldn't blame her, because he was a sneak. He really cheated a little bit on that agreement. But I remember another case, interesting sidelight. She got the story about Ingrid Bergman's extramarital relations with Rossellini when it happened. And I came into the studio to announce the show, and she was in tears. She's completely in tears. And I said, what's the matter? They said, don't say anything to Luella. She's all broken up. I said, what seems to be the difficulty? The director said, well, she's in an awful personal dilemma. You see, she has gotten a story about Ingrid Bergman, who has been been having an illicit affair with her famous Italian director, Rossellini. The story is out, but nobody knows it but Luella. On the other hand, Luella is a dear friend of Ingrid Bergman's, and she doesn't want to break the story. She feels that this has got to crucify her and her motion picture career. It's a terrible thing to do, and she doesn't know what to do. So I walked over to Luella and handed her a handkerchief and chatted with her and said, Luella, now you'll be on the air tonight. How long do you think it's going to take for this story to break in somebody else's column? She said, oh, they'll have it first part of the week, no question. I said, you want Hedda to print it before you? Can't you do it and cushion the blow and do it in a gentle way? You know that news is news and you can't withhold it. Wouldn't you rather be the one to break it gently and as a friend and express how sad you are that it happened and that you don't? You know, in other words, instead of making it a scandalous release, she jumped up off the chairs upon which she was stretched and said, you're so right, Marvin, and I'm a fool, and I should have seen it that way. And so she broke the story. Like many others, it was a good story. It was one that had to come out. You know it was going to come out. And she scooped everybody else. I remember that. That was Luella. That's the way she operated. She never really did say what the imitators did so often.
Marvin, did you know Jack Benny was born in India?
Turned the page.
Napolis?
That was always one of the all-time gags. She had a little difficulty making herself sound interesting, but she was interesting, and she sure had a nose for news. She was a great lady of the press, no question about it. And I enjoyed all the 9 or 10 years I was on her show. I also happened to hit a lot of the kid shows in those years when kid shows were big in radio. They weren't ever as big out in the on the coast as they had been in Chicago and New York. I mean things like Jack Armstrong and Little Orphan Annie and things that go way back, on which I played, of course. But the ones here were usually one-a-weekers on weekends. One of the top ones in popularity was on Saturday morning and was called Smilin' Ed McConnell and His Buster Brown Gang. And I worked that every week. Always a different character. They had 4 running storylines, as well as all of Smilin' Ed's gambles with the kiddies in the audience and the crazy songs he sang and the strange characters he impersonated. There was a frog whose voice he did and so forth. But there was always a storyline in it, too. And there were 4 young heroes who alternated. One was an American Indian. One was an India Indian, a Mahout, an elephant boy. And incidentally, that later got on television, that whole series. Not made in India by a long shot, made out of a jungle compound, but with many of the radio actors who were in the original radio shows being now on television. June Foray, Lou Krugman, some of those great old names who are still very much around and very busy, I'm glad to say. But I worked that every week, and the other one was Lassie.
From Hollywood, John Morrell and Company, makers of 3-flavor Red Heart, America's favorite dog food, presents Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's lovable motion picture star, Lassie.
And that was a funny thing because Lassie was a 15-minute Saturday afternoon show on which Lassie actually came down to the studio and appeared. Rudd Weatherwax would set a chair up on one side of the stage. Of course, it always was packed with kids. These kid shows really pulled them into the studio that were equipped as theaters. They'd turn them away. It really had to. There were hundreds of kids. And on Lassie, I worked that one every week, too. There were always individual stories with no running characters. There was no sidekick character to go along with Lassie, as there was on the subsequent television shows, in which the family structure has been changed some 5 times, as our viewers know. On this, every story was completely separate, completely apart. And thanks to my ability to do many dialects and many kinds of characters, I played a different role every week, of course. But it was very, very funny because Rudd Weatherwax, the trainer, would stand just off the stage, Lassie seated on the chair, and when a bark cue came up, Rudd would raise his hand and Lassie would bark. And Lassie would bark obediently until Rudd would lower his hand, and that was that. Now, when it came to whines and growls, you couldn't depend on Lassie as much as you could for the barks, so they had an animal imitator off the stage on the other side. And when Lassie would grab the trouser leg of a villain and worry it and go... It was the animal imitator whom the kids never saw. And you never saw so many surprised kids because they loved the idea that Lassie barked, but they never could see Lassie doing anything when she growled, you see. Ah, the illusions of radio. Speaking about illusions, one of my favorite roles in radio, I suppose, was on One Man's Family. One Man's Family, of course, is one of the longest running of all radio shows. It started out as a half-hour show. I think it was heard on Sunday afternoons or evenings and then Sunday mornings. By the time I got to the coast, it had become a five-a-week strip show, just like most of the soap operas. The director of the show at that time was the same director who had done Ma Perkins for so long in Chicago, George Fogel. And George immediately started calling me for parts on the show. I played dozens of parts on that show until finally a new character came in who was supposed to be a running character, and George cast me in it. I saw what the role was and said, "George, you're out of your mind. This is about as far from anything I've ever done." He said, "Marvin, I couldn't find anybody else in town who could play it who was available. And you can do the things I want you to do, so do it." So I did it. He was an 80-year-old New Englander named Consider Martin, who was a cousin of Fanny Barber, Mother Barber, of course, the head of the family. And he came in as the absolute antithesis of everything that Father Barber stood for. Father Barber believed in all the family virtues and in success by hard work. Consider had been the son of a strict New Englander who died when Consider was 45 years old, and he suddenly realized that all his life he hadn't had any fun. He inherited a considerable amount of money, so he decided to spend the rest of his years throwing it away. So he went out with as many women as he could find. He was on an eternal bender. He was the absolute opposite of anything you associated with hard-nosed Yankeeism. He just was not a typical Yankee, but he had to sound like one. And, of course, the story went, he would invest in useless stock, and then he'd make a killing. So everything he did with his money, which was pointedly foolhardy, turned out successful, and he became a millionaire for no reason at all. This is what Father Barber couldn't stand. So whenever he came to town, he'd lead the younger barbers astray by taking them out in pursuits which Father Barber considered sheer folly, and wind up completely debilitated and have to be nursed back to health in the barber home by Fanny, his cousin. It was a funny, funny role. And that's, of course, is part of the great joy of radio. You got the chance to play roles if you could do them vocally and intellectually and emotionally that you would never be able to play as an actor in any other medium, because you couldn't conceivably be the visual prototype of this role. This man, as I said, was 80 years old. He was a little gnome-like character who must have weighed 100 pounds dripping wet. He was full of apothegms, of wise old saws, but his main idea was that people didn't have enough fun, and he dedicated himself to seeing that they did. And he's quite a philosophical old geezer.
I don't think I got a recording of him, but he sounded a little bit like that.
Now, you can see I can never do that today in television, could I? Not at my weight. But he lasted for 6 years and went out of existence only when the series went out of existence. And it was through that role that I got to know Carlton Morris and work on all his other shows as well. Speaking of doing odd voices and so forth, another show I did for about 2 years, I don't imagine many of our audience will remember this one. It was a Sunday morning half-hour sustainer. CBS never made any attempt to sell it, so we had a full half-hour to tell the story. That was one break, because it assumed the impossible task of telling the story of the world's greatest novels, the world's greatest stories. This was called Tell It Again. We did things that were aimed at young people, but not kids. People who were going to high school, who were studying literature. Some of our subjects were The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Les Miserables, two of Victor Hugo's. We did Treasure Island. All the classics, the great stories. I was the narrator on it, but the producer, Ralph Rose, who also wrote it, producer, director, writer, the works, had a great deal of respect for the things that I did, so he always let me play roles on it. I always played something as well as narrating it. But very, very often, I had a chance to do the lead. And some of my fondest memories of dramatic roles were on that series. Oh, we had good cast, too. I remember I did Quasimodo in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I don't... Notre Dame, if we have some purists. I don't have a recording of that. I did Javert in Les Misérables, the role that Charles Laughton made so famous in the screen version with Frederick March. But our Frederick March, our Jean Valjean in Les Misérables, was Ira Grossel, better known as Jeff Chandler. We did Don Quixote. And guess I was Sancho Panza, of course. Guess who Don Quixote was? Hans Conried. Can you think of a better one? And so it went. One show after another with great actors in it and wonderful stories. And golly, it's things like that that make you wish that maybe radio could come back.
Silence!
Your Honor! Your Honor, that man is not Jean Valjean.
Have you proof of your statement?
Yes, Your Honor. Indisputable proof. I am Jean Valjean.
Thank you for admitting it, criminal Valjean, second offender.
Second offender? What do you mean, Inspector Javert?
The bishop's candlesticks, remember?
Remember those characters? The bishop and his candlesticks, Inspector Javert, and Jean Valjean, the man who spent 19 years in prison for the theft of a loaf of bread? Sure, they're from Les Misérables. Tell it again. Tell it again. Dramatizing the great stories we all know and love. Today, Les Misérables by Victor Hugo, and we tell it again. Countries in Europe, France has perhaps sustained the most violent history down through the centuries. With France torn by internal strife and revolution, fought over by its own monarchs and leaders, the almost constantly changing conditions had their effects on the people. For it is the people who suffer or gain through the wisdom and mistakes of their leaders. And it was about the people of France in the late 18th century that Victor Hugo wrote, "The poor people, the unfortunate people, Les Misérables." Valjean was one of those poor unfortunates. His sister had died and left him with the care and support of seven small children. He worked hard to discharge the obligation, but it was no use. The peasants were poorly paid, and it was all they could do to obtain enough bread to keep from starving. That was all Jean Valjean wanted, a loaf of bread for himself and the seven hungry mouths he had inherited.
What's that? Here! Come back! Thief! Stop, thief! Stop!
Order here. Prisoner Jean Valjean, you may speak.
Sir, I took only a loaf of bread. One loaf of bread. My sister's children are starving. They have no food, none at all. I took a loaf of bread for them.
Your Honor.
Yes?
I am Javert, the gendarme who arrested this criminal. It is not important why he stole or what he stole. It is only important that he stole. The courts of France must deal harshly with thieves and criminals. If not, we cannot consider ourselves fit to administer the affairs of our new republic.
But, sir...
Silence! Jean Valjean, you have committed violent burglary in an inhabited house between the hours of sunset and dawn. The law is quite specific. 5 years in the galleys are too long.
You know, the trouble with reminiscing with my radio friends is there's just too much to talk about. And I haven't even had a chance to tell you anything about activities in television, current television, or for that matter, in motion pictures and one other field, recording. I'll just drop in a little mention. I did have the privilege of recording 8 books. That's 4 albums, one on each side. of the great Dr. Seuss stories for kids. And I won Grammys for the best children's recording in two successive years, 67 and 68. One of these, or rather several of them, will probably be seen shortly on television in an animated feature, and I'll be allied with it. I don't know just exactly what I'll do, but some of those records were Horton Hatches the Egg, Green Eggs and Ham, that's what won the Grammy, The Sleep Book, If I Ran the Zoo, and The Fox and Socks, The Sneetches, Yertle the Turtle, and Bartholomew and the Oobleck. Wild yarns by a wild and very, very talented and imaginative man. I've always enjoyed working with Ted Geisel, alias Dr. Seuss.
All ashore! The men shouted, and down with a lurch went Horton the Elephant, still on his perch. Still on the egg that could just scarcely hold him. Bump, Horton landed. And then the men sold him. Sold to a circus. Then week after week they showed him to people at 10 cents a peek. They took him to Boston, to Kalamazoo, Chicago, Weehawken, and Washington, too. To Dayton, Ohio, St. Paul, Minnesota. To Wichita, Kansas. To Drake, North Dakota. And everywhere thousands of folks flocked to see and laugh at the elephant up in a tree. Poor Horton grew sadder the farther he went. But he said as he sat in the hot, noisy tent,
I meant what I said, and I said what I meant. An elephant's faithful. 100%.
But that really isn't radio, is it? And there's still a few things. Oh, there's so much to talk about. One thing I must mention is my long association with my all-time favorite musical show, The Railroad Hour. The Railroad Hour, as you may recall, starred Gordon McRae. He started it as a 45-minute show on ABC, and it then moved over to NBC in a half hour. This was a tough show to condense because it did all the all-time great musicals. But they condensed them. And then during the summer, they'd have a series of originals, sometimes based on the life of a composer, using all of his greatest tunes, sometimes sheer original musicals, made up out of whole cloth with perhaps works that were not from musicals, I mean songs that did exist that could be tied together to tell a story. I was the announcer on all of these, and I also had an opportunity to play parts in it. You see, it's an important thing to remember. See, I wasn't just hogging all the glory by doubling in roles. You got an extra check for it. And it was one way to get paid more than what you would normally get. So obviously, I was always on the lookout for a role I could play, and I'll never forget, on the Railroad Hour, one of my joys came when Fortunio Bonanova, who was to sing the role of Pompino in The Cat and the Fiddle, of Jerome Kern. The last minute, he dropped out with laryngitis. I was called at home early on a Monday morning. The show was rehearsed starting at noon on Monday and went on the air at 5. It was repeated in the evening by transcription, of course, but the early shot went to the east. I was called at about 9 o'clock by the director, who in a frenzy said, Marvin, can you hit an E above C? And I said, what the heck are you talking about? He said, well, this is a French character, and I don't know anybody else in town that I can get who can do a good French accent. And I know you're not a singer, but doggone it, it's more important to get the good French accent than it is to get somebody who's a great star. So I said, well, what do I have to do? He said, you have to sing 4 songs. But the one I'm worried about has an E above C, and that's The Night Was Made for Love. You remember how it goes? I said, yes. He said, go over to the piano, play it in the key of C. So I did, you know. La nuit est pour l'amour. You know. That isn't in C, by the way. But they didn't have time to rearrange it, you see. This was broadcast day, and you had no chance to do anything about it. So I hit the E, and I cracked wide open, and he said, that's all right, it's a character role. So I came in and sang the role as well as announcing the show, and I won an award for that. Used to be a radio magazine in town at that time. I can't remember the name, but I won an award that year for the best substitute radio performance of the year. A category that had been created that year for just two of us. Joan Banks won it for the girl, for substituting for Kathy Lewis on My Friend Irma, who Kathy had been ill for quite a while, and Joni took it over.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Railroad Hour. And from Hollywood, here comes the star-studded show train. Tonight, your railroads, through the Association of American Railroads, present the charming operetta, The Cat and the Fiddle. In our star-studded cast, you will hear the host of our series, Gordon McRae, two famous guest stars, Miss Reza Stevens and Mr. Adolph Monjou, and a great cast of Hollywood featured players. Our choir is under the direction of Norman Luboff, and the entire production is set to the music of Carmen Dragon's orchestra, and brought to you by the American Railroads. The same railroads that bring you most of the food you eat, the clothes you wear, the fuel you burn, and the things you use in your daily life. And now, here is Gordon McRae.
Thank you and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Gordon McRae helping to bring you another in our series of musical comedy successes. Tonight, the Railroad Hour show train presents The Cat and the Fiddle, a musical love story by Jerome Kern and Otto Harbach. As our first guest tonight, we are extremely happy to present one of the most charming ladies of the Metropolitan Opera, Miss Reza Stevens, whose lovely voice will be heard in one of the songs she is supposed to have written in her role as Shirley Sheridan, a young American composer.
Try to forget who's you, all you have meant to me, all I have meant to you too.
My role this evening is that of Victor Florescu, also a composer, but my music is of the more serious type, as you will hear when I sing,
"One moment alone is all that we own, and yet in that instant reigns."
Also on our guest list is the popular Hollywood motion picture star, Mr. Adolph Monjou. Mr. Monjou plays a producer of musical shows who seems to prefer Shirley's music to mine when he says,
"That man should be put away, preferably behind bars, where I won't be able to wring his neck."
Our story opens in Paris in the spring. It is dusk, and the setting sun is reflected in the river Seine, which flows by the Cave Voltaire. Here, vendors are busy selling their flowers, their vegetables, their old books and maps. Along the street comes Pompano, a vendor of music selling songs of love. Many are the lovers whose lips have met as Pompano strolled by singing,
"La nuit est pour l'amour, la nuit est pour l'amour."
Bravo, bravo, monsieur. Votre chanson est très jolie.
Oh, merci, mademoiselle. Voulez-vous acheter une copée?
Ah, oh, mon monsieur. Non, pas aujourd'hui.
Ah, mademoiselle is American, hein?
Is my accent that bad?
Oh, Pompino tells not only by the accent, mademoiselle. He tells by the look in the eye.
The look in the eye?
Certainement. Americans in Paris always have the look of hope that something will happen.
Something?
Oh, but yes, romance.
And don't Frenchmen have a look of hope?
Mademoiselle, Frenchmen do not hope. They know it will happen. Breathe the air. Look around you. Romance is everywhere. And while you sit here on your bench waiting, I have the charming American song for you. Here, I sing it.
She didn't say yes, she didn't say no, she didn't say stay, she didn't say go.
She only knew that he'd find her there, and then she knew he sat beside her there.
Mademoiselle knows it.
Mademoiselle wrote it.
Mais no.
Mais yes.
Oh.
See, right there, Words and Music by Shirley Sheridan. That's me.
Incredible.
Well, take the music away. I'll show you. She didn't say yes, she didn't say no. She didn't say stay, she didn't say go. She only knew that he'd find her there. And then she knew he sat beside her there. At first there was heard not one little word. Then coyly she took one sly little look. And something awoke and smiled inside. Her heart had started beating wild inside. So What did she do? I leave it to you. She did just what you do too.
She didn't say yes.
She didn't say no.
She didn't say stay.
She didn't say go.
She only knew that he's by her there.
And then she knew he sat beside her there.
Something awoke and smiled inside. Her heart began beating wild inside.
So what did she do? I leave it to you.
She did just what you do too.
She didn't say yes. She didn't say no.
One moment alone, 'twas then I was shown a glimpse of an angel fair. Too much for a mortal, that's why it ended there. One with a tooth and a smoke and a little laugh, that little smile. Then
now wait till you hear the next one.
Well, I for one intend to hear no more. Victor's beautiful music ruined.
Oh, death.
I will listen to no more. If you wish to see me, I will be in my apartment.
And what do you think, Victor?
Unfortunately, Monsieur Daudet, that is also my opinion. Easy, commercialized emotion sickens me. Good night.
That man should be put away. Preferably behind bars, where I won't be able to wring his neck.
Victor, Victor, please.
Oh, forget Victor, my dear. Frankly, I'm not at all sorry they've left us. Come, my dove, I have a bottle of Napoleon brandy I've been saving for just such an occasion. What does the most beautiful composer in all Paris say to that?
What does she say, Jules? Da 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 dee dee, da dee 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 dee.
Well, I don't quite understand.
She wanted to stay, but thought she should go. She wasn't so sure that he'd be good. She wasn't even sure that she'd be good. She wanted to rest, all cuddled and pressed. A popular part of somebody's heart. She loved to be en rapport with him, but not behind a folding door with him. So what did she do? I leave it to you. She did just what I'll do too. Good night, Jules.
Shirley, Shirley, come back, my dove.
I'm not a dove, I'm a homing pigeon.
Ah, Mademoiselle Sheridan.
Oh, Pompino.
When Pompino decides to watch over someone, he watches. Come, I'll take you home, my pigeon. My bicycle is here.
Bicycle?
A tandem. Oui, with room for two. Have you never bicycled through the bois in the moonlight?
There's always a first time. Let's go.
Mademoiselle, you are comfortable?
Yes, but not very happy.
You and that young composer, you're having trouble, huh?
Oh, Pompano, I don't understand it. I fixed his music and did all I could for him. And did he appreciate it? No. He laughed at it and left with Odette. That cat with her fiddle.
You must not jump to conclusions. Perhaps there is a reason, a very simple one. If you will but go to him and give him a chance to explain.
Well, I...
Oh, but of course, if Mademoiselle insists on being stubborn, I...
No, 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 Pompino, no. Take me to him. Take me as quickly as you can. Nothing matters except his love.
The night was made for love. The night was made for love.
that nighttime sighs for. So come we are to lovingly hold you while two lips on fire have ardently told you of sweet desire.
Mademoiselle, and there is Victor's door. Go quickly, quickly, up the stairs with you.
Victor, Victor, are you there? Victor, Victor, it's Shirley. Please let me in.
What goes on in here? Oh, it is you, Mademoiselle Sheridan. Your studio is on the other side of the court.
Madame, has Monsieur Florescu come in yet?
Oh, mais oui. In like a storm and then right out again like a hurricane. Bag and baggage.
Bag and baggage? He's gone?
He says he's through with Paris for life. And if any mail come for him, tear it up. I go back to bed now. Bonsoir, mademoiselle.
Bonsoir, madame. Oh, Victor, Victor. I loved you so.
Here's a bit of news which means something to everybody who uses transportation. And in this country, that's all of us. The other day, the Association of American Railroads completed arrangements to build a new railroad research laboratory. It's going to be located on the campus of the Illinois Institute of Technology at Chicago. From this laboratory, much of the widespread engineering and mechanical research of the industry will be directed. This new development is completely in line with the long-time practice of the railroad industry. For many years, research has been carried on by and for the railroads in the laboratories of universities and technological institutions, and manufacturers of railroad supplies and equipment. Research has been carried on the railroads, which in addition have served as the proving grounds for the testing and trial of ideas, no matter where developed. There are two things we should keep in mind about all railroad research. One is that railroads don't make things to sell. They buy things, all sorts of things, from manufacturers and use them to produce transportation service. As a service industry, therefore, railroads receive the benefits of research done by almost every manufacturing industry in the country. And another thing to remember is that the railroads which serve you can never shut down to retool for next year's models. So everything new that is introduced on a railroad must work right along with what is already there during a necessary period of transition. That's why progress on the railroads is and must be an evolution, a growth, not a revolution. This new research laboratory to be built by the Association of American Railroads on the Illinois Technology Campus is another forward step in a long-continued cooperative program that is going forward today more actively and on a broader front than ever before. You will see its results more and more in the new equipment coming into service on the railroads in ever-increasing numbers, just as one part of what Mr. Kettering called the amazing progress of the railroads. The show train will return in just a moment after a brief pause for station identification. Now back to The Cat and the Fiddle, starring Reza Stevens, Adolph Manjou, and yours truly, Gordon McRae. And here's Pompano continuing the story.
For days I searched all Paris, but I could find not one trace of Victor. Then one day, as I was passing Shirley's window, I heard her talking to Dodé.
No, Jules, my mind is made up. I'm sailing for America on the first boat I can get, and I won't allow any of my songs to be used in Invictus Score.
You're throwing away your big chance, my dear.
I'm sorry, Jules, but that's final. Come in.
Mademoiselle.
Oh, what is it, Pompano?
Mademoiselle, you must give up this thought of going to America.
Oh, I'm sorry, Pompano, but there's no reason for me to stay.
Just because your composer has vanished. All you have to do is get him back.
Well, he'll never come back.
Ah, but of course he will. He composed this operetta, no?
Yes.
And Monsieur Daudet wants to produce it if some of your songs are used, no?
Of course I do.
Then let it be produced.
Pompano, what are you talking about?
Mademoiselle, angry lions could not keep a composer away from hearing the opening night of his first operetta.
Oh, Pompano, I think you might be right. You're a genius.
Naturellement, the greatest genius in all Paris.
Shirley, I'll give it the most brilliant opening this town has ever seen.
For once it appeared that Pompino, the greatest student of human nature in all Paris, was wrong. At the opening of the operetta, Shirley and I stood in the lobby, watching every member of the audience. But nowhere did we see Victor. Patiently we waited all through the show.
Oh, Pompino, what a pity Victor can't hear how everyone loves his music.
Ah, Mademoiselle is too generous. They like your music,
too. But listen, they're going to do the finale now, and I didn't touch one note of it. It's all Victor's.
Is out on the stage.
Messieurs, mesdames, I thank you for the manner in which you have received tonight's operetta. You have called for the author. Actually, there are two of them, but I can only guarantee producing one.
I won't go up there.
This one is standing in the wings, where he has been standing all evening. Monsieur Victor Florescu.
Victor! Victor Pomino, did you hear?
If you enjoyed tonight's production, it was because of my collaborator. For it was she who supplied the happiness that is in it. And if she is in the audience, I beg her to come up here and stand beside me where she belongs. Are you out there, Shirley?
Yes, Victor, yes. Here I am.
Run, go up there.
Yes, Pompano.
Shirley, my darling, are you coming?
Yes, Victor, yes.
Here, my dear, right up those steps.
Oh, thank you, dear.
I've lost you, but what hits I'll get out of you and Victor.
Shirley, my darling, kiss me.
No, in front of this whole audience?
Why, even your Aunt Hester would approve this time. I'm asking you to marry me.
Oh, Victor.
Give us a song! Hey!
All right, you two, save that clinch till later. Sing!
The nighttime sighs for soft hungry earth. The night was made for love.
So with a sigh, I, Pompino, the greatest romantic genius in all Paris, slipped out of the theater. Mission completed.
So very glad to be sitting high and dry, looking for a night was made for love. A night was made for love.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This is Gordon McRae giving a special vote of thanks to our guest stars this evening, Miss Reza Stevens and Mr. Adolphe Monjou, and to the other members of tonight's cast for their fine performances in our production of The Cat and the Fiddle, which was adapted for radio by Mr. Don Ettlinger. Next week, our star-studded show train will arrive on the same tracks at the same time. On board will be the Metropolitan Opera soprano, Miss Dorothy Kirsten, and Kenny Baker to join me in bringing you the famous Sigmund Romberg operetta, The Student Prince, with our chorus under the direction of Norman Luboff and the music arranged and conducted by Carmen Dragon.
All aboard!
Well, it looks as though we're ready to pull out. So, until next week, goodbye. Remember, during the coming week, as always, the American Railroads will provide for you the dependable, low-cost transportation which is so essential to the American way of living. The Cat and the Fiddle has been presented by special arrangement with Hans Whitmark Music Library. Mr. Monge will soon be seen in the Warner Brothers picture, My Dream Is Yours. Gordon McRae appeared on this program by arrangement with Warner Brothers. This is Marvin Miller speaking. The Railroad Hour is brought to you each week at this time by the Association of American Railroads. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
I did the Railroad Hour for something like 7 years, and when it died, radio kind of, I don't want to say died, went into a coma. I haven't any business talking about my other activities, but I suppose the thing people will remember me from both in the field of, best in the field of television, is The Millionaire. The Millionaire was the story that ran for 6 years first run and 5 years daily on the CBS network after that. I was Michael Anthony. I gave away the $1 million checks. I was also the announcer on many TV shows. I was Dinah Shore's announcer during all her years of selling the USA in your Chevrolet. I announced the Danny Thomas shows on their first run. There were very many shows that I was announced on, but I also played in many roles. I actually created one of the earliest series. Didn't create it, but I mean, I was the star of it for about a year that ever came from Hollywood and television, a thing called Mysteries of Chinatown, in which I played a Chinese detective. And this led me into many roles as an Oriental in motion pictures. Smuggler's Island with Jeff Chandler, The Golden Horde, in which I played Genghis Khan, Peking Express with Joseph Cotton, Corinne Calvet, and Edmund Gwen. I was the top villain in that one. That was my Chinese cycle. I had quite a few of those. And incidentally, I made the famous Volkswagen television commercial in which Charlie Chan appears. I was Charlie Chan. In fact, I did Charlie Chan in various versions on the stage and in commercials, and yet I've never played it in a picture. Someday, if they ever decide to revise that one or revamp that one, I might take a crack at it, unless they can find a good, honest-to-God Chinese actor to play, which is what they should. But, of course, no Chinese ever sounded or looked anything like Charlie Chan did, so there you are. Other pictures that I may be remembered for, I played a Japanese police chief in Blood on the Sun. That was my first picture with Jimmy Cagney. I had a very good role with George Raft in two pictures, Intrigue and Johnny Angel. Johnny Angel was my second. I was the heavy in that, married to Claire Trevor. Hoagy Carmichael was in that picture, too. I did a picture with Susan Hayward and Bill Williams called Deadline at Dawn. It was kind of a good show, a William Irie story. And then there was Shanghai Story. I wasn't a Chinese in that one. I was a communist Czech. I did a couple of real hard-bitten heavies. One was Forbidden, in which Tony Curtis made one of his first big smashes. In fact, I was in the first picture Tony Curtis ever starred in, The Prince Who Was a Thief. We had a big dueling scene in that with scimitars, and as I whirled the scimitar back over my head, I cut the rope that held up the portcullis at the castle, and it fell on me and killed me. I don't remember that scene well.
Not really, folks.
I've also been associated in television. I'm just doing this hit or miss with a lot of cartoon shows. I was Aquaman. Not many people realize that I was a wet, fat Batman, but Aquaman I was while it ran. There was also another series called Fantastic Voyage, which was a spinoff of the picture by that name, which a submarine was miniaturized and ran through a man's bloodstream. Well, from that story came animated Saturday morning, you know what. Three people played all the roles. Young lady Jane Webb played the girl and all any other female roles that came along. Would you believe Ted Knight, who's the funny newscaster on the Mary Tyler Moore show, played two of the roles. He was the scientist and he was the leader. I mean, not the leader, but the captain of the ship. I was the leader, the man back at home base, and I also did the young juvenile and the Swami. And this Swami was a guru who could hypnotize people by merely looking at them and having the right thought. Speaking of Hindu things, one of the things I did that I'll never get credit for was looping all the voices in the Maya television series. This was made in India by the King brothers, and they couldn't use 1 foot of the track. So it was brought back here, and if there was an American guest star in it, he did his own lines by looping them. All of Jay North's lines and Rajat Singh's lines, who were the two young leads, were done by a young man here whose name escapes me. A very, very good vocal imitator. He could sound exactly like either the Hindu boy or Jay North. June Foray did all the little kids and the women, and there weren't too many women, and I did all the rest. All the rest of the male roles in the entire series. I did as many as 17 parts in one episode. And had to do British, American, Hindu, you know. Kind of fun. And that was all lip sync. That means you have to watch it, you know, sentence by sentence and lay in the line exactly what they say. Nobody even knew that show was looped, as a matter of fact, which I'm very proud of. But you don't get the credit for it. Looping is the thing that I've done a lot of and you'd never get credit for. In The Return of the Seven, the Mirage picture, which most people have seen many times on late TV, or not so late either, as a matter of fact, because that was a not too far back release. The heavy role in it was played by Emilio Fernandez, who's a very famous Mexican actor. I looped his lines. For some reason or other, his just didn't come out. So it not only had to fit and be undetectable, but it had to sound like legitimate Mexican. And nobody complained, so I guess we were successful. That's the trouble with somebody who works with the voice a great deal. You don't get the credit. You once did in radio because at the end you took credits. But nowadays you don't get them in television. For instance, in the past couple of days, I have done three new things in television, which you'll be seeing probably. One of them is announcing a Baskin-Robbins Chocolate Festival commercial, a very funny little 30-seconder. I played Santa Claus in two spots for Zales jewelry stores. They'll be shown in any city where there are Zales. I did that two spots in one day, and it ran like 20 hours. As a matter of fact, I did them the night before I'm recording this little chat. So if I sound a little dull, you'll know why. And the third one was the voice of the Cheshire Cat for a new MD tissue commercial for Georgia Pacific, which will be all over the screens in the morning hours in the months to come. I also do the grapefruit-flavored Tang commercials. I'm the old man in the chair with the querulous voice, and I do the straight announcer lines, too. So that's a good one. That means a little added income. So I stay kind of busy, as you may have gathered. I'll have a picture coming out this fall. Pretty good part in it, too. The Naked Ape. The book was quite a success, a popularized anthropology book. I play the father figure, the boss figure. For once, I don't have very many lines, but I'm on screen a lot because portly and solemn and very definitely a figure of authority, I bumble my way through the film. It's an interesting picture. Half of it will be in animated cartoon stuff. That'll be the animal portions. which Murakami Wolf will do. The rest of it will be live action. And interestingly enough, it's produced by Hugh Hefner. It's a Playboy production to be released by Universal. And the last shot that I did in the picture, which I enjoyed very much, not because I have anything against Mr. Hefner, in fact, I like him, was in Chicago, where we shot a large portion of it in the Field Museum because of all the prehistoric exhibits there. But the last thing I did was drive a brand new Lincoln Continental through the garage door of Hugh Hefner's house. It wasn't a real garage door. It was made out of balsa wood. But it was at his house, because he lives on the near north side in Chicago and has a mansion. And this is the father figure, having had too much to drink, coming home late at night, can't see the garage door, and goes through it. So I did it. Now, there's a piece of dramatic ability you don't get many kudos for. The great thing about radio, of course, as I have always felt, was that it demanded more of the audience than so many other media. In radio, the audience had to design the costumes, create the sets, and even cast the characters. Oh, after they got to be top stars and made away in their way in movie like Burns and Allen and Jack Benny and Bob Hope, that was a different thing. But I'm talking now about the big radio dramatic serials and so forth. You didn't know what these people looked like. You had your own images. So you actually created something. You didn't have it all spelled out for you, as is the case with television, which I don't want to knock or anything. But there's still nothing that will quite take the day and the place of those days in radio where you stood with a script in your hand in front of a dead can and made all the world come to life. And if you could believe it, the listeners could believe it.
Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
Be with us next week for another nostalgic look at radio of yesteryear.
Now it's just about time we were picking up our members and moving along our way. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these songs and the memories that go with them, as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. And I'll be keeping my weather eye peeled, yes, sir, looking for you all to join us the next time we drop around this way for a friendly little get-together. And I hope that'll be real soon, folks. And until then, this is your old friend Singin' Sam saying goodbye for now.
Same Time, Same Station is produced for KRLA News and Public Affairs by John Price. Associate Producer, Cam Currier. Special Research by Martin Halperin, and I'm Bill Browning. Our gratitude to Marvin Miller for the memories and transcriptions used during the past 5 weeks.
Be sure to be with us next week at this same time, same station.